We're holding on Chofgalad Amud Bey's the last line. We're in the middle of learning about the dinim of an Eved Knani going free if his master knocks out his eye or his tooth, which it says in the Psukim, or any of a bunch of other Roshei Evadim, a bunch of other important parts of the body, as we discussed before, as now soon we're going to have a list of them in the Gemara. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chiba Ashi, Amar Rav, Hoysalo Yiseres, if the Eved had an extra finger, Vachasacha, and the Oden cut that off, Eved Yitzben L'Cheiros, that's also a valid reason that the Eved goes free. We discussed yesterday whether he needs a Shtau Shichru or not, but the point is that the master has to free him under those conditions. Because after all, we learned yesterday that it has to be mum shebegolui va'inichoyzer. It has to be a visible mum and something that won't regenerate. And this finger is like that. It's a mum shebegolui because you can see that he used to have six fingers and now he has only five, and it's einichoyzer. However, amar Rav Huna v'hu shenisperes al gav hayad, that would only be if this extra finger is counted on the back of the hand, meaning in other words, it's in the same row as the other fingers. Otherwise, it's not really considered an aver at all. And you have that comes up as far as other halachas as well, where only if you have it, only if you have it in the same row as the others, is it really considered a finger. Okay, more on this topic about an Eved Ivri and what kind of things might be that are done to him would cause him to go free. So the Gemara introduces the next part of the story. Sobe de Nizunya, the elders of Nizunya, which is the name of a place, loy also lepirke de Rav Chista. They did not come to Rav Chista's Drosha. A pirka, in particular, is the kind of Drosha. It was a Drosha they would often have on Shabbos or times like that. It would be a Drosha on practical halacha. So we're not talking, in other words, about one of the shiurim in the yeshiva. We're talking about something where primarily he would be teaching practical halacha, and everybody would come, the Talmid Chachamim and the Amei Ha'aretz. So these Sobid Nezunya didn't show up for that. So Rav Chista tells Rav Hamnuna, who was a Talmud of his, actually based on the continuation of the Gemara, the Rivosh learns that actually, to be exact, Rav Hamnuna was a Talmud Chover of Rav Huna, meaning he is in a certain sense his Talmud. He needs to know certain things in Torah that Rav Huna knows and he doesn't know yet. But on the other hand, he's of the caliber to also be the chover, to also be the colleague of Rav Huna, where Rav Huna is also dependent on him. Because we're going to see in the Gemara soon that Rav Hamnuna is going to answer a question in halacha, or is going to attempt to answer a question in halacha when Rav Huna is around. And if he was an actual Talmud, he wouldn't be able to do that, as the Gemara tells us elsewhere. So it has to be he was a Talmud chaver. Anyway, so he tells, so Rav Chista tells Rav Hamnuna, zilt san inhu, go san inhu. San inhu Rashi means tell them to stay home. In other words, it's a way of putting a Talmud chacham in nidui. The Gemara tells us in Moed Katan, if a Talmud Chacham requires Nidui, you don't tell him, you don't bring out the shofaris and make a whole publicity of it like you do for other people. Instead, you tell him, he covered v'shev v'secha, hold on to your honor and stay sitting in your house. But it's meant for him to understand that he's in Nidui. So Rav Chista is telling Rav Hamnuna, go to these Sovin in Azunya and tell them that they need to be in Nidui for not coming to my Drosha. Now, why? What is it? Does he need his covered or something? Ben Yehoyada explains, because he wants to, you need to make sure the Amei Ha'aretz come to these kinds of Drosha so they learn practical halacha. If the Talmid Chachamim don't come, then the Amei Ha'aretz may figure we don't need to bother either, and therefore that bothered, therefore Rav Chista was bothered by that, and he wanted to make sure they come. So Ozel Omelahu, so Rav Hamnuna goes and asks them, my time alay also Rabban on the Pirka, why didn't you Chachamim come to the Pirka, come to the Drosha? So they answered, and my nese, why should we bother going? To be in me name Milsav alay Poshetlan. Previously, we asked him things and he didn't answer. Now, one explanation of that is that, in fact, it means that during a previous pirka, they had asked him something in the middle of it, and he hadn't answered. So they figured it means he doesn't know anyway, so why should we bother? But really, the reason would have been just he didn't want to interrupt the drasha. On the other hand, Ben Yehoyada says that the vort is not that he didn't answer at all, but when he answers things, He tends to just answer simply yes or no, also or mutter or whatever. That may be fine for the Amoraites, they said, but for us, Tamar Chachamim, we require something more. We require him to be explaining to us, and he's not. So why should we bother? Omelahu, Sarav Hamnuna says, "Mi ba'itu minai midiv le'pashit nalahu. Have you ever asked me anything, and I haven't answered it to you?" So again, how does that answer the objection? So if you say the objection was that he b'chlal didn't answer the question, then Rav Hamnuna is telling them, fine, he didn't answer the question in the middle of the pirka, in the middle of the shir, because he didn't want to, and in the middle of the drasha, because he didn't want to break off in the middle. But you know that previously that you've been able to ask me and you always get an answer from me. Or if you say, like Ben Yehoyada says, that the vote is they're saying all he gives us is like one word answers, also remoter, then Rav Hamnuna is saying, yes, but I'm his miturgamon. In the past, whenever you've had him say something is this is also this is mutter or whatever, you've always been able to come over to me and I'll clarify and I'll explain the basis behind it as is appropriate for Tamar Chachamim like yourselves. So you should come, and if you have that problem, then I'll fill in as I always do. Okay. So they said, so they decided to ask him a question. And then based on that, they'll see whether it's worthwhile coming in the future. So they asked him, Eved Shesirsei Rabbi Bebeitzin. Suppose that you have an Eved Kanani, and his master castrated him by damaging his Beitzin. Is that enough? Is that considered the kind of mum that would allow him to go free? The question is, K'mum Shebegoloi Dami, do we consider it like a visible mum? Because the beitzim, of course, are inside the sack in the body, but they're noticeable from the outside. So maybe therefore that should be considered a mum shabagoloi, or is it not? Would it be considered like a mum on an internal organ of the body, and therefore that wouldn't be enough for him to go free? There is an interesting explanation in that as well, that I think the Pnei Yeshua says if the master had actually cut them off, first of all, there are Rishonim would say if he actually removed them altogether, there's no question it would be a mum shebegoloi. The question is that he didn't actually remove them. They're still in there. They're just cut off. But there is an interesting point as well that if he had actually done a maaseh on them themselves to cut them or damage them, he would be chayev malchus for that, and eidonim loiko mashalim, you have the rule that a person doesn't get malchus and have to pay a monetary fine, so therefore we couldn't necessarily say that that would be enough for him to also be having to free the eved. We'd have to be talking about where the siddus was accomplished using some other way, for example, by giving him some kind of potion that causes him to become sterile, or for example, by putting him in heat or cold in a way that damages those parts of the body without actually touching them, whatever the case. That's the question. Is Sirus considered a mum shebegoloi or not? So loy have a biyade. Rav Hamnuna did not know the answer. Omru loy mashimcha. So they asked him, what's your name? As the Gemara is going to go on to say, like they're going to do like a play on words on it. Omrulahu Hamnuna. My name is Hamnuna. Omrulay, they told him, Lav Hamnuna Ela Kanun. Your name is the appropriate name for you is not Hamnuna, but rather Kanuna. Now, what do they mean by that? The Oruch actually says that they're not making fun of him or anything. They're doing a play on words. The word nun in Aramaic, nuna in Aramaic means a fish. Ham is similar to the word ham, which means hot. Kara means cold. So the Oruch brings an explanation that it's not so much they're making fun, Tosfos brings a variant of it, but anyway, that not so much they're making fun of him as just they're saying, you know, it's ironic with a name like Nuna, your name ought to have been Karnuna, cold fish, because fish, after all, are cold-blooded creatures, and instead it's funny that your name is Hamnuna, which suggests a warm fish. But anyway, so according to that, they're not making fun of him. They're just they're playing off his name. However, most of the Mephoshim understand that they are in fact making fun of him and putting him down for the fact that he couldn't answer their question. Rashi says the word Karnuna is related to the word Keren, as in you're Yoshev Kronis. Instead of being Hamnuna, which the Ritva fills in, that Hamnuna would be be Meloshin Naaman, that you're faithful and always you're faithfully found in the Beis Medrash. Instead of that, apparently you're Karnuna, you're no more than a Yoshev Kronos, one of those people who sits on street corners idly, if you haven't learned enough Torah to be able to answer this question. And Tosfos brings from Rabbeinu Hananel an explanation somewhat similar to the one from the Aruch. The Rabbeinu Hananel was in fact one of Rav Nosson Bala Aruch's Rebbe's. Anyway, the answer is that we'll say they're saying you're not a hot fish, you're not a hamnuna, you're a cold fish, karnuna. Which there's a further explanation in that from one of the Mephoshim and one of the rarer Mephoshim on Ein Yaakov called Ein Eliyahu, where he says, they're telling him, look, a fish only lives as long as it's in water, as we know from the story of Rabbi Akiva. So it has its heat only when it's in the water. You take it out of the water, it cools off and dies. So you, who are not fatifing zich and Torah enough, you're like a cold fish compared to a hot blooded fish while it's in its element. Another idea, where one of the Mephoshim says, is they're saying to him, like, you know, you eat hot fish, it's delicious. You eat cold fish, it's not as good. The same way, like, you're like a cold fish. You know, you're not giving us an answer or a reason for this halacha, so it's like something not as tasty. Whatever the case, the point is they're telling him you have to apply yourself more. Also, the Kameid Rav Chista, so Rav Hamnuna went back to Rav Chista and told him the whole story. So Rav Chista tells him, you should realize Masnisa Bo Minoch. What they were asking you, you can actually find the answer in a Braisa. Now, first we have to have a Mishnah, which gives us the background, and then the Braisa is going to give us more detail. The Mishnah in Negoyim says, Esrim Ba'abar Roshe Evorim Sheba Adam, there are 24 tips of limbs on a person, Kulam Ein Matamin Mishum Michya. None of those are metame a person if there's a michya on them. Now, the Torah tells us in Parashas Tazria, when it goes through all the dinim of tzaras, you have a case where a person has a spot of tzaras on his skin. So you have the kohen has to check it out. You have certain things that are simoni tumo that make it that it's definitively tame. And then you have ones where he has to quarantine the person for 1 week or 2 weeks and see what develops. One of the cases, the Torah says, is if you have a michya, if you have an area of healthy looking flesh, in the middle of the tzaras spot, then that's an automatic simen tumah. It's an automatic simen. The person is mukhlat. He's definitively a mitzvah. However, the pasuk uses the expression over there, l'chol mare enei hakohen. It has to be in all the visible sight of the kohen, which means we learn from that. Therefore, if you have a michya on an area of the body which is not flat, but is more three-dimensional, so then when you look at the tip of the aver, you're not going to see, for example, a fingertip, to take one example, you're not going to see the entire michya, because some of it is going to be on the fingertip, and some of it is going to be on the sides. So therefore, so we learn from that a michya would not make a person tome if it was on his fingertip. Now, you have actually, it's actually not so simple. The minimum size of a michya, in order to be metame, is the size of a certain kind of bean. So you would have to have that. What we're talking about is a typical fingertip is narrower than that. So therefore, you're not going to have the entire size of the michya. You're not going to have on the top of the fingertip. If it happens that a person has very specifically, actually, the size of a michya is a lentil. So if you happen to have a person who has fingertips that has very fat fingers, and the top of his finger is the flat top of his finger is wider than a kadosha, then yeah, he would be tummy from that. But normally not, because most people's are not. There is a machlokas b'shonim whether this applies only to a michya, whether it applies to other simonim of tzaras as well. What if the regular tzaras itself is on the fingertip? Would that be metame? One point is that one of the other simone tuma of tzaras is that you have two white hairs grow on it. Well, if it's on the fingertip, you're not going to have hairs grow over there. Anyway, the point is the Mishnah is saying that there are 24 areas on the body where you have something three-dimensional like that, and therefore michya, or possibly tzaras in general, on that part of the body is not going to be metame, because again, you can't see it all at once. You have to like turn your head this way and that, or turn the person's finger this way or that, in order to be able to see all of it. And the pasuk is saying that it needs to be able to be seen all with one glance. So the Elohim, they are as follows: Roshe Etzbos Yadayim Raglaim, the fingertips and the toe tips. So that's 20 so far. The Roshe Osnayim. Then you have the tips of the ears. So the Pashtos, it means anything along the edge of the ear. So it can mean anything from the earlobe all the way up to the top of the ear. Any of those areas where you have the edge of the ear. The Rosh HaChotem, the tip of the nose, same idea. The Rosh HaGvia, the tip of the male organ. The Rosh HaDadim Shabaisha, and the tips of a woman's breasts or nipples. All of those, again, are this three-dimensional kind of thing, where if there's a michya on them, you're not going to see it all in one glance. You would have to turn it this way and that. Rabbi Yehuda Ema'af Shabaish, Rabbi Yehuda says not only a woman's nipples, also a man's. The Tanakhama will say a man's are more flat. So therefore, it's not in this category. Rabbi Yehuda says they are. Anyway, so that's the Mishnah. The Tani Allah, then we learn in a Braisa that explains that Mishnah. B'kulam Eved Yotze Behen L'cheirus, that also all of those are things that an Eved would be able to go free if his master damaged or cut off one of them. So far we don't yet have about Sirus, because all we had was Rosh HaGvia, the tip of the male organ. But the Braisa continues, Rebbe Omer Afa Sirus. Rebbe says that also Sirus, also castrating the Eved, allows him to go free. Ben Azay Omer Afa Loshen, and Ben Azay says also if the tongue is cut off. The point is, in other words, we learned yesterday that in order for it to be a mum that allows the Eved to go free, it has to be a mum shabagolu. It has to be a mum on a visible part of the body. And we're saying that Rebbe holds that Sirus, and Ben Azay holds that damaging the tongue is also considered a mum shabagolu in the case of the tongue, because when a person speaks, you can see their tongue. Anyway, so therefore, so Rav Chista tells Rav Nuna, so these Sovei Dinezunia who asked you whether ever Chesirse Rabba Bebeitzim, they were asking you if you're familiar with this Braisa, and if you would, then you would have answered that Rebbe holds that's enough for the Eved to go free, and the Chachamim hold that not. So now we're going to analyze that point in grin, and now we're going to analyze this Braisa in greater detail and figure out why Rebbe says what he does and why Ben Azay says what he does. One point in this, by the way, is it sounds like from this Braisa, that from this Mishnah and Braisa, it sounds like you only have about two. First of all, the Mishnah, the Braisa don't mention the tooth and the eye. The Braisa in particular doesn't mention the tooth and the eye, because it says, though, in the Pasuk, it doesn't need to repeat those. But still, it comes out from that maybe not every part of the body is something that would allow him to go free. Now, we had, for example, yesterday, we had the din about where the master yanks on the Eved's beard and dislocates something in his jaw. We said he goes l'cheiros with that. So now that's not listed in the Braisa over here. So does that mean he doesn't go free with it? There are Rishonim who learn, in fact, that this Braisa that we just quoted now argues with that statement that we learned yesterday. And that would mean the halacha is not like that one. The halacha would be, in fact, that if a jaw is dislocated, it's not enough reason for him to go free. On the other hand, the Rambam doesn't hold that way. The Rambam, we learned yesterday, says that when the jaw is dislocated, means the teeth that are attached to that jaw are not going to be able to function properly. So therefore, that would be included in the teeth, and therefore the Braisa over here doesn't list it, because, again, the Braisa here is not listing the tooth or the eye at all, because they're already mentioned in the Pasuk. Anyway, so the Gemara says, Omar Mar, so now we learned in the Braisa, we said, Rebbe Omer Afasirus. When we said, Rebbe says that also if the master castrates the Eved, then he goes free. So, Sirus Demai, in what way did he castrate him? Obviously, you have different organs over there that can be damaged that would have that effect. You have the Beitzim, and then you have the Gid. So, Ilema Sirus the Gid, are you telling me that Rebbe is talking about the case where the master cut off the gid, the actual the male organ? Well, Hainu Gria, the Tanakhama already mentioned that. He mentioned Rosh HaGvia, which is the tip of that organ. So yeah, of course, the Tanakhama already says that would be enough for the Eved to go free. You don't need Rebbe. You don't need Rebbe to be adding that point. Elalav Sirus Debetzin. Obviously, therefore, Rebbe must be adding also where he was Mesaros him in the Beitzim, and Rebbe is saying that's enough for him to go free. So again, that would be the answer to Savid and Azunia's question, that Rebbe would say that's enough. The answer is Rebbe would say that that lets him go free, and the Chachamim would say that not, because they don't consider that to be a Mum Shabagoli. Okay. So now let's see. We said Rebbe Omer Afasirus. Now, so what are we saying? We had the list of the 24. I mean, the Brice actually, the Mishnah had called it 24, and the Brice had said those are whatever Yotzibam Lecherus. I mean, if you actually count it down, the Mishnah is really kind of combining together a couple of body parts together. For example, Rosh Eosnaim, the tips of the ears, you have two of them, one for each ear. Rosh Dadim Shabisha, same thing. So it really comes out, even though we're calling it 24, really what you have is 26 for a woman and 25 for a man. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, the other way around, because he includes Rosh Dadim Shabisha, man's nipples as well. So according to him, you would have a little more. But whatever the case, plus in the case of the Eved, you have Shein V'ayin. Now, so Rebbe is saying, besides that whole list, you also have to add Sirus. The question is, for Rebbe Loshen Loi, are you telling me that Rebbe would hold that damaging or cutting out the tongue is not considered a mum shabagalui? So in other words, it sounds like only Ben Azai is saying that you have to add the tongue. It sounds like Rebbe disagrees and saying the Tanakama and saying that the tongue is not considered an exposed part of the body. So the problem with it is, Uruminu, I have a contradiction. A Braisa says, Hare Mishahoya Mazer, suppose a person is sprinkling paradroma water to make people and Pelim Tahar, Vinitza Hazar Alpiv, and a drop of the Hazar lands on his mouth, where we'll see in a minute what part of his mouth we're talking about. Now the vote is, it has to be, even one drop of paradroma water landing on a person is enough to make him tahor. However, again, it has to land on his skin, someplace on the outside of his body. So here, if it landed on his mouth, Rebbe says that's considered a valid hazah, and the Chachamim say that not. So my love al lashona, shouldn't we understand that the machloikas is where the drop of paradroma water landed on his tongue. So therefore, the Chachamim, fine, are being consistent. They're saying that the tongue is not considered a dovish of a galui. Therefore, they say it's not enough, that an Eved won't go free with that. And also, therefore, Hazor won't work on it because you need the paradroma water to touch something on the outside of his body. But Rebbe then seems to be inconsistent. Why is it here he's saying that it's considered a hazar because the tongue is considered exposed because it's visible when you speak and because you can stick it out. But when it comes to the Eved, he seems to be saying that not. So the answer is loy al sfasav, not necessarily. You could say that the machlokas and the braisa is talking about where the hazar landed on his lips. Of course, if it lands on his lips, it's poshut that those are exposed. What's the problem? Why are the Chachamim holding that that's no good? And why does Rebbe have to tell us that it's fine? The answer is ma'udatemet zimnin d'cholim sfase. Because after all, sometimes you can have a person purses his lips. Sometimes you have a person closes his mouth in such a way that the entire red area of his lips is not visible. So maybe therefore you should consider it's not necessarily an exposed area of the body, Kamash Malan, therefore, Rebbe said, and that might explain, in fact, that would explain why, in fact, the Chachamim don't consider it to be an exposed area, precisely because of that, because sometimes people do purse their lips, and then all of the red area is covered, but Rebbe disagrees, and Kamash Malan, that's what he wants to tell us, that despite that, the lips are still considered a dovish of a govern. But not necessarily, they're arguing about the tongue. They might both agree that if the paradromal water lands on the tongue, it doesn't work, and therefore Rebbe would be consistent. So therefore, both the Chachamim and Rebbe would be consistent with their opinions that the tongue is not a dovish of a galui, and therefore doesn't allow the Eved to go through. Only Ben Azai would be disagreeing with that. However, the Gemara asks, "V'hatanya al lashonai?" We have another Braisa that clearly says that the machloikas between Rebbe and the Chachamim is where the Hazar landed on his tongue, and where Rebbe is saying that's considered a Hazar, implying that Rebbe considers the tongue to be something exposed. But Oid Tanya, furthermore, we learn in a Braisa when it comes to mumim of a bechor. So these the Gemara, the Mishnah and Bechoris and the Gemara over there discusses the various mumim that could be in an animal which make it disqualified to bring as a korban. It's in the Masechta Bechoris, because primarily you have the most common application of it is you have an animal that's a bechor, where if it doesn't have any of these mumim, then you bring it as a korban. And nowadays you would have to wait, since we don't have korbanos, then you have to wait until it develops a mum, and only then can you shecht it and eat it. So therefore it's important to know the list of mumim, but once you have that list, then it applies to all korbanos as well. Anyway, so there's a braisa over there listing the mumim that could apply to an animal. The braisa first says v'shenital roiv haloshen. If most of the tongue of the animal was removed, then that would be considered a mum. Rebbe omer roiv hamadaber shivoloshenay, and Rebbe says it's not. We don't just mean the majority of the tongue. It would be the majority of the speaking part of the tongue. Now animals don't speak, of course, but what we mean is we're using it as a borrowed term from human beings. Meaning, in other words, when you think of the tongue, you have a part of it that's attached in your mouth and can is impossible to move or to stick out, and then you have the part that's not attached and is free to flap around. So Rebbe is calling that area, the part of the tongue that's able to move relative to the rest of the mouth, is called hamadaber. It's called the speaking part of the tongue. So Rebbe is saying that if most of that was removed in an animal, then that would be considered a mum, as opposed to the Tanakama. You'd have to consider also the whole tongue, including the part that's further back in the mouth. Anyway, the point is that, again, a mum is only something on a body part that's visible. If you were to have, for example, an animal that some internal organ has been removed, let's say it's in a way that doesn't make it trefa, for example, the spleen was removed, then it wouldn't be considered a mum. You may not be able to bring it as a korban, but it also wouldn't be the kind of mum that you could shecht the bechor on. If we're calling over here, both the Tanakama and Rebbe are calling the tongue something to which mumim apply, and the machlokas is only how much of the tongue has to be missing for it to be considered a mum, then obviously they're considering it a dovish of a golem. Not like we said that Rebbe maybe would consider it, that Rebbe would consider it not a davar shebegalui. So what's going on over here? Why doesn't Rebbe? Why is Rebbe only saying atasirus and meaning apparently not the tongue of the eved that would allow him to go free? Why only the 24 or 26, or however you count them, things that the Tanakhama had said plus sirus? So the answer is Ella Rebbe omer sirus v'loy miboya loshen. Rather, you have to answer, when Rebbe says afasirus, what he means is, needless to say, the tongue would be included. But also, sirus, even though we're talking about, as we established before, sirus to beitzim, we're talking about only that the beitzim were damaged or cut or whatever. So it's not so visible, because after all, they are in their sack. Nevertheless, that's enough of a mum shebegalui, because the fact is, you can see the shape of them and everything from the outside of the sack. And therefore, that's enough, therefore, for it to be considered a mum shebegalui. So when Rebbe says asirus, he doesn't mean to exclude the tongue. He means to say the tongue, obviously, is a davar shebegalui, consistent with his opinion as far as hazar, and consistent with his opinion as far as mum bechor, but he's adding also sirus, which is less visible than that. Okay, now let's analyze Ben Azai. We said Ben Azai omer loshen. Ben Azai had said afa loshen. Now, avos sirus loy. Now, on the other hand, Ben Azai apparently does not include sirus as something that the eved would go free. Because otherwise, if he did, of course, then he'd be saying exactly the same thing as Rebbe. There'd be no reason to mention his opinion. So umay af akamaisa. So therefore, when Ben Azai says af haloshen, he can't mean af haloshen in addition to sirus that Rebbe mentioned. Because then he'd be saying exactly the same thing as Rebbe. Necessarily, his af haloshen has to be referring back to the Tanakama. You, Tanakama, have listed 24 or 25 or 26 evodim, depending on how you count them, that an eved goes free. I'll tell you, another one is af haloshen, also the tongue, but not that he's including sirus. So the Gemara asks, "Hachi nichtema de ben Azay b'reisha." In that case, then shouldn't we put Ben Azay's opinion before Rebbe's? The order should be that the Tanakama lists his 24, or however you count them. Then Ben Azay says Afa Loshen, and Rebbe would say Afa Sirus, and then we'd understand also, like we said before, Rebbe is including both Loshen and Sirus. Ben Azay is including only Loshen but not Sirus. Why is the Braisa written in such a confusing way that we would think that Ben Azay agrees that Sirus is included as well? The reason is Tana Shama Le Rebbe. What happened was the Tana first heard Rebbe's opinion, the cover, then he established it in the Braisa. So now when people were learning that Braisa Baal Peh, they had the opinion of the Chachamim and followed by the opinion of Rebbe. Later on, the Tana, the author of this Braisa, found out about Ben Azay's opinion, and he added it to the Braisa. But as we often say, the Mishnah doesn't move from its place, meaning once you have a Mishnah or a Braisa that's well known and learned by heart by all the Talmidim, and they're used to the Lashon of it, you don't want to insert something in the middle because it'll confuse them. So therefore, if you're going to add anything, you're going to add it at the end. So once they were used to that, we learn the Chachamim's opinion, and immediately after that, we learn Rebbe's Afasirus, and then we didn't want to interject Ben Azay's opinion in the middle, so therefore he put it at the end. But in fact, the order would be that the Tanakama holds neither one of them. He holds the 24 Rosh Evarim plus Shein V'ayin, and that's it. Ben Azay holds also the tongue, would be that an Eved Yotze Ben Lacherus. And Rebbe says the tongue, needless to say, would Sirus as well would be counted. Okay. Talking more about this matter, we mentioned before about this matter of the tongue and the question of whether the tongue is considered to be an exposed part of the body as far as this din of the Eved, and also we mention it in connection with the halachas of Tumah Matara. We said that if a drop of paradrum of water lands on the person's mouth, in particular on his tongue, then we said it may not be a valid hazar. First, we thought that itself would be the machloikas of Rebbe and the Chachamim. Then we said not necessarily. The machloikas could be about the lips, because sometimes a person purses his lips, and so his lips are not visible, but the tongue, everybody would agree, is not considered a davish of a gadol. Or, of course, you could say that the machloikas is on both the tongue and the lips. Anyway, so Oma Ola, Hakol Modim Baloshin L'Inyan Tuma. Everybody agrees regarding the tongue when it comes to Tuma Vatara, when it comes to if something Tome touches it. Now we know by the same token, a person, a Tome thing touches a person anywhere on his body, he's going to become Tome. But you have the same kind of thing where it has to be an exposed part of his body. To take an example, if let's say somebody were to take an object that's tame and stuff it down somebody else's throat in a way that and stuff it down somebody else's throat in a way that it doesn't touch any outside area of his body, then that other person wouldn't become tame, with the unique exception of nivla soli fatura, which we're not going to get into right now. You have other examples like that as well. Anyway, other areas of the body where something might be inserted like that. Anyway. When it comes to the tongue, is definitely considered exposed. The golu who eats all sherets. If a sherets, for example, were to touch a dead sherets, were to touch somebody's tongue, no question, says Ola, everybody would agree that the person becomes tummy. My timer, asher yiga boy al marachmona, because the pasuk says asher yiga boy, that the pasuk says that he touches it. Now, which pasuk are we referring to? So Rashi says you have like this. The pasuk says regarding a zav, v'chol asher yiga boy hazav, anything that a zav touches, the yodav lo shotaf b'moyim, where he hasn't previously washed his hands in water, then that thing becomes tameh. Now, when we say wash his hands in water, what we really mean is going to the mikveh, because just washing his hands is not going to be enough to take away the tumah of a zav. What it means is, in other words, So the Rashi brings from a Gemara in Nida, it means, in other words, that if the Zav touches anything with a part of his body which is similar to his hands in being exposed, and he had not yet gone to the mikveh, then he's metame, whatever it is that he touches. So we learn from that, therefore, that Tumah V'Tahara, when it comes to the dinim of Tumah V'Tahara, it depends whether it's an exposed area of the body or not. Tosfos over there in Nidda learns a bit differently. They say that actually we're learning it from the fact that whenever the Torah talks about Tumah V'Tahara, it always mentions touching it, which again implies touching it with some visible, with some exposed part of the body, whatever the case. So everybody agrees that the tongue is considered exposed relative to the Tumah of Asheretz. My time, Asher Yigah by Omer Rachmana, because the expression in the Pasuk is that he touches it behind Nami, by Negiyahu. You're capable of touching something with your tongue because you can stick out your tongue and you can touch something with the tip of it. So therefore, definitely the tip of it is considered a Dover Shabagolim. On the other hand, La'inyan Tevila Ketamun Dami. On the other hand, when it comes to toveling, then everybody agrees that the tongue is considered something concealed. Meaning, we know that when you're toveling, the water has to reach every part of your body. But you don't have to have, for example, let's say when you're in the mikveh, you don't have to open your mouth so that water should get into your mouth and touch your tongue. Relative to that, it's considered an internal organ and the water doesn't have to touch it. My time of a rochatz b'sorei b'mayim omer achmana, because the pasuk says about tevila, he should wash his flesh in water, which means ma b'sorei me'avroi, his flesh, his skin is something visible on the outside. The same thing. What parts of the body have to be able to touch? Have to touch the mikvah water. Has to be the outside area. Has to be the outside areas of his body. Rashi makes a point over here, which is that you anyway can't stick out your entire tongue because, like we said before, you have part of your tongue that's attached to the other muscles and inside your mouth. And you can't stick it out anyway. So what would we say? You have to stick out the part of your tongue that can go outside you, that can stick outside your mouth. And toivel that, there's no such thing as tevila l'chatzoyin. There's no such thing that half of something should be toiveled and half not. So since you can't toivel the entire tongue anyway, then you're not obligated to stick out the part that does stick out. And you also don't have to open up your mouth to let the mikvah water in, because they're, for sure, the inside of your mouth is not considered a dover shebegolim. So the machlokas Rebbe and the Chachamim about the tongue is strictly about hazah, about sprinkling with paradrum water. So the machlokas is Rebbe medami lo l'tuma, v'rabbanan medami lo l'tvila. Rebbe is comparing sprinkling of paradrum water to becoming tomei in the first place. So the same way as a dead sheretz or other source of tuma touches a person's tongue, and he becomes tamei. The same way, when it comes to sprinkling with paradrum water, then we would say that if the paradrum water touches his tongue, then it'll make him tougher. On the other hand, v'rabbanan midam lo l'tevila, the chachamim compare it to tevila. The same way as by tevila, you don't have to stick out your tongue and you don't have to open your mouth. The mikvah water doesn't have to touch your tongue b'chlal. The same, so it's considered an internal organ. The same way, as far as hazah, it would also be considered an internal organ. Tosfos points out, by the way, that when we were just, how did we get into this whole discussion, is because we're talking about the Eved and what he goes free with. Maybe in fact, we could say before when we discussed about the tongue, whether Eved Yotzeh and Lacherus, maybe there's a difference between Tumah V'Tahara. Maybe they were saying you can compare it to Tumah or you can compare it to Tevila. The fact is, though, we know that Shein V'Ayin, consider Shein V'Ayin. An Eved goes free if his eye or his tooth is knocked out, but you don't need the eye to touch the mikveh water either. You can close your eyes in the mikveh. You have to have your teeth touch the water of the mikveh either, because again, you keep your mouth closed. So therefore, obviously, the conditions by an Eved are not the same as they are by Tevila. By the way, worth mentioning in this connection, it does mention in halacha, for us men, when we toivel, it's not particularly relevant because we're not really toiveling as something required by halacha for Tumah V'Tahara. The only case it would be relevant pretty much is when a ger toivels. It is more relevant when women toivel. You are allowed, of course, to keep your eyes and your mouth closed, but you're not allowed to keep them tight closed. The eyelids, for example, you can't close your eyes tightly, because then you have, as we're going to see in the Gemara soon, you have areas around the eyes where water can't get in. And the same thing with the mouth. If you purse your lips or if you close your mouth very tightly, then you have the same problem. So you have to close them, but you close them loosely. Anyway, So getting back to the Gemara over here. So again, the question is, when it comes to becoming tomei, the tongue is considered exposed. When it comes to toveling in the mikveh, it's considered covered. When it comes to hazah, which one do we compare it to? The tavayu b'hai kro kamifugi. So Rebbe and the Chachamim are arguing within the following pasuk. When the pasuk says about hazah, the hizah hatorah ala tomei v'gomer, the tohar person should sprinkle the parah druma water on the tohar person and on the tomei person. And the pasuk continues. So the whole pasuk goes like this: V'hiza atorah ala tomei b'yom ha'shlishi v'yom ha'shvi. He sprinkles on him on the third and the seventh day. V'chitoi b'yom ha'shvi. Then he cleanses him on the seventh day, and then v'chivas begodav v'rochet b'mayim v'torah ba'odav. And then he puts himself and his clothes in the mikveh and toivels and he's torah that evening. So now, what is the v'chitoi referring to? Rebbe Sava v'hiza atorah ala tomei b'yom ha'shlishi v'yom ha'shvi v'chitoi. Rebbe says that the word v'chitoi refers back to the first half of the pasuk. When the Torah sprinkles on the Tomei on the third day and the seventh day, and the v'chitoi, which means that he cleanses him, it refers back to that. So when he sprinkles on him in a place where previously he became Tomei and now he can become Torah, so in other words, Rebbe is saying, in effect, that you have a hekesh over here, you have a hekesh over here between tumah and tara, the word v'chitoi, which is the hazah, and the word hatome, which means the tomei. So in other words, you have ala tomei, and then you have v'chitoi, so you have a hekesh between them. Anything that's considered exposed as far as tumah is considered exposed as far as hazah. V'rabbon and sabri, the chum say, no, the v'chitoi goes with the second half of the pasuk. V'chitoi b'yem ha'shvi, he cleanses him on the seventh day, v'chibetz b'godav v'rochatz b'mayim, and then he dips his clothes and himself in the mikveh. So therefore, just the opposite. The hekesh is between hazah and tevilah. So therefore, they say if the tongue is not considered exposed as far as tevilah, then it's not considered exposed as far as hazah either. Well, the question is why each one learns the way he does. Why don't the Chachamim learn the hekesh the way Rebbe does, that the comparison is between tomei, where it says ala tomei, and then it says v'chitoi? And the answer is they say tara mitara avalei lemelach. More logically, we're going to learn a process of tara from another process of tara. Going to the mikveh is a process of tara. Sprinkling with parah druma water is also a process of tara. So therefore, we should compare those two rather than comparing to becoming tomei in the first place. So Rebbe nedamia l'tevila. So why doesn't Rebbe agree with that? And the answer is because he says v'chibus god of hifsika inyan. He says because you don't really have a hekesh there anyway. You have the words v'chibes begodim in between the v'chite b'yem ha'shvi and the v'rochatz b'sorei. So therefore, so v'rochatz b'mayim. So Rebbe would say that you anyway don't have a complete hekesh between the hazah, the word v'chito, which means he cleanses him, and the v'rochatz b'mayim, which means that he has to toivel. So therefore, so that breaks things up. And therefore, that's telling you don't learn one from the other, rather learn from the word hatome, which is closer to it. Where all you have in between is Bayim HaShlishi or Bayim HaShvi, which is just describing the days. It's not describing the actual process of Tara. And therefore, Rebbe says you can learn one from the other through this Tekish. Okay. So the question is, V'sova Rebbe le'inyan Tevila ketamun dami? You're telling me that Rebbe holds, when it comes to Tevila, that the inside of the mouth is considered like a concealed area and you don't have to have the water go into it. V'ha'amad Ravin Amarab Ada Amarab Yitzchak. It happened once with a maid servant in Rebbe's household, where she needed to tovel, shetovla. So she tovel, shetovla also. She tovel and then she came out of the mikveh. And then they found a bone stuck between her teeth. That while she had toveled, that bone was in there. And Rebbe told her she needs to tovel again because there was a chatzitza. So you see, therefore, that the inside of the tongue, that the inside of the mouth, between the teeth, chatzitza is relevant, which implies that water has to come in there. The answer is, the Gemara says, no. You don't have to have that the mikvah water actually goes into the mouth. But you do require that it should be a place where water could come in. If you were to open your mouth, then you need that the water would go in. You need it to be able to touch every place inside the mouth, and that there shouldn't be a chatzitza, such as a bone or something like that, stuck between the teeth. This is where we have the whole concept of getting rid of chatzitzis before we go to the mikveh. Again, for us men, it's less relevant. For women, though, they have to check carefully to make sure there are no chatzitzis anywhere on their body, including, yes, inside their mouth. For that reason, they brush their teeth and they floss and so on and so forth. Kidder Abzera. This fits like the way Rab Zera says. The Amr Rab Zera, kol roi labila ain't bila ma. This is a rule that we have throughout Shas. That Rab Zera says the original context where Rab Zera said this was in connection with a din in Menachos. The Mishnah says over there the maximum size mincha that you can bring is 60 isarin. Why not more than 60? So the Gemara gives the reason over there, because the flour and the oil of the mincha need to be mixed together, and when it's so large, you're not going to be able to mix them. So the Gemara asks why. Well, who cares? You anyway don't need to mix the flour and the oil for it to be a kosher mincha. So Rav Zera says his rule: kol haroi labila, something that is capable of being mixed, ain bila ma'akevus, but then the fact that you didn't mix it is not ma'akev, and it's still kosher. But if to begin with it's not capable of being mixed, then the fact that it can't be mixed is ma'akev. So that's why you can't bring a mincha of 61 or more esrenim, because it's not capable of being mixed b'chlal, and then the fact that you can't mix it is ma'akev. So by the same token over here, if you have no chatzitzis in your mouth and your toivel, you don't require that the water actually comes in between your teeth and around your tongue and whatever, but you have to have that it would be capable of going in and touching every part if you did open your mouth, and then if there's a bone or whatever stuck between the teeth, then you don't have it, so therefore that would be considered a chatzitza. Tosfos, by the way, brings up the point that usually we have a rule with Kodshim that says Shana Olava Kosov La'akev. Whenever you have something repeated in the Torah in connection with Korbanos two or more times, it means that detail is ma'akev. By Menachos, it mentions in many places that the mincha is mixed with oil. Why don't we say that the bila is ma'akev? And the answer is, Tosfos says, because the fact is it never actually says you should mix it. It just describes the descriptive thing that the mincha consists of a mixture of flour and oil. So it's not shana alo akos of la'akev. That would be if the Torah had said in two or more places, you shall mix the mincha uvalalta or something like that, then yeah, it would be ma'akev, but like this, no. So yes, Rebbe says that the tongue is considered covered as far as tefillah. So he doesn't require that the mikvah water touch it, but he does require that the mikvah water could be able to touch every part of it if the person did open his mouth. Okay. So the Gemara says, going back to this matter of sirus bebeitzim, which began the original discussion, the Gemara says ketanoi. There's actually a machloikas tanoim on this. Now, we had a machloikas of Rebbe and the Chachamim, but now we have additional tanoim who argue on that point. Now, the Pasuk mentions, when it comes to mumim of an animal that you can't bring it as a korban, it mentions four things. Umoch v'chosus v'nosuch v'chorus. Moch and chosus both mean like squashed or crushed or something like that. Rashi on the pasuk explains that moch is more damaged than moch is kind of damaged, and chosus is more damaged. Whatever. The pasuk is talking about things that make the animal sterile, things that castrate the animal, so they involve one of the organs, one of the parts over there that an animal needs in order to be fertile. So if it's torn off, which Rashi explains on the pasuk over there means, and also over here Rashi explains, nosuk would mean they're completely disconnected, but they're still inside the sac over there. You haven't actually removed them. And then chorus would mean that they're cut off from the beitzim hang from various cords and ducts and things like that. So nosuk would be that all of those are completely disconnected, but the beitzim have not been removed. They're still there inside the sack. And chorus, meanwhile, would be where they're partially cut off, but they're still partially attached with some of their ducts and things. So those four, the pasuk says you can't bring them as a korban. So what parts are we talking about that were damaged like that. Kulan bebeitzim divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that all of those apply to the beitzim. That's considered, again, when it comes to a mum of an animal, it has to be that the mum is begolui in order for it to be considered a mum. So Rabbi Yehuda says the beitzim are considered golui, are considered exposed as far as this purpose. So the Gemara asks, bebeitzim veloi begid, what does Rabbi Yehuda mean? It applies only to the beitzim. It doesn't apply to the actual, to the actual gid. That's for sure more exposed. Ella, what he means is kulan af the beitzim. He means that all of them apply also to the beitzim. Don't think they apply only to the gid, which is very clearly visible. They apply even to the beitzim because even though they themselves are not visible, the shape of them is visible from the outside. Rebbe Eliezer ben Yaakov, I'm a kulan begid. Rebbe Eliezer ben Yaakov says no, they only apply to the gid, not to the beitzim. Rabbi Yossi Yomer, and Rabbi Yossi says it depends. Moch v'chosos af the beitzim, the first two moch v'chosos, where they're crushed or squashed, that would apply to the beitzim as well, because that's more noticeable. Nosuk v'choros, but when they're cut off, when they're partially cut off, which is chorus, or when they're completely torn off, which is nosuk, begid ein v'beitzim loy, then Rabbi Yossi says that would apply only to the gid, not to the beitzim, because the fact is they're still there inside the sack, and they're still whole. Unlike moch v'chosos, where they themselves have been squashed or crushed, here nosek v'choros, you've only cut off the connections that they have to the rest of the body, the muscles and the ducts and whatever that connect them to the rest of the body, but not the actual beitzim themselves. So Rabbi Yossi says, therefore, nosuk b'chorus would not apply to the beitzim, only to the gid where they are. If that's been cut off or partially or completely, then it's very noticeable. So the point is, therefore, when we said before, we have the machlokas, whether sirus bebeitzim is considered a davar shebegalui, that where Rebbe said that yes, he would agree with Rabbi Yehuda in this braisa. When the Tanakama said, and Ben Azai had said that sirus bebeitzim is not considered a davar shebegalui, they would hold like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, and then you'd have Rabbi Yossi takes a middle ground between them, that certain things are considered begalui regarding them and others not. The halacha in the end is, As far as the sirus bebeitzim, the halacha is like the chachamim, not like Rebbe, and not like Ben Azai. So the answer is that no, those things would not allow an eved to go free. However, Rishonim say if the beitzim were actually completely removed, then yes, it would be considered a davar shebegalui because then it's very noticeable on the sack over there that there's nothing inside it. Having talked now about since we started the parak by talking about Ha'isha Niknis, how a man acquires a wife, Kesef Shtar and Bia, and so forth, and then eventually we started talking about Eved Ivri, Omo Ivriya, now we talk about Eved Knani, Shifcha Knanis, so now we're going to go on to other things, how you koina them. The next couple of Mishnayos are going to deal with Dinim of Kinyan, even though you would think this kind of thing belongs more in Baba Basra. But it's over here in Kiddushin as a continuation of the dinim of Kinyonim that we've learned so far. So the Mishnah says, Behema gasa niknis b'mesira. A large animal, for example, a cow or a horse, can be acquired by mesira. So the original owner of the animal gives it over to the other person. Rashi explains, for example, he hands him over the reins, or he hands him over, take a hold of its hair or something. Now Rashi says means that it would not, that meshicha would not work with such animals because it's not, you don't usually do that. You don't usually have such animals walk in front of you. Therefore, that wouldn't be considered a valid method of kinyan when it comes to large animals like that. Tosfos has a long discussion about that and disagrees and says not necessarily. It may mean that mesira works and meshicha works as well. The hadaka, as far as a small animal like a sheep or a goat that or a chicken or some other small animal like that, bahagba, that you're koina by lifting it up. So again, Rashi says not with meshicha because again you don't usually have it just walk in front of you. So when it comes to a behemagasa, you can't physically pick it up. Therefore, the chachamim don't say you have to do that. Obviously, if you have some way of picking it up, so let's say you get a coin or something and you lift it up, that for sure would be good. Hagbar is always good for being kona things, but when it comes to a behemah gasa, the chum didn't impose that on you. Mesira is fine, but with a behemah daka, the Tanakama is saying over here, you have to do hagbar, you have to actually lift it up. Divrei Rabbi Meir of Rabbi Eliezer. That's what Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Eliezer says. There's an error. On the side of here, maybe it's not Rabbi Eliezer, but rather Rabbi Lozer. Rabbi Eliezer is from an earlier generation than Rabbi Meir, so then you would expect to list him first. If you say Rabbi Lozer, that's Rabbi Lozer ben Shamua, who was a chaver of Rabbi Meir, so therefore it would make sense that they're listed in this order. So that's the Remeir and Rabbi Eliezer. B'chamim behemah daka nichnas b'mashicha. The Chum say no. A behemah daka can be a small animal, can be acquired with mashicha. That, for example, we learned a few days ago. You call for it and tell it to and then tell it to come and it comes over, or you hit it with a stick and make it move or whatever. However it is, all those kinds of things. Hagbah would definitely work. The Chachamim say, but you don't need hagbah like Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Lozer are saying. Meshicha is enough for a behemah daka. The Gemara starts off. Dorash Rav. Now Rav Darshin b'Kimchunya. Rashi that Rav Darshin in the city of Kimchunya. He said not like it says in our Mishnah. Behemah gasa niknis b'meshicha. He said a large animal, a cow or whatever, can be acquired through meshicha. So later on, Ashkechinu Shmuel the Talmid of Rav. So Shmuel later on met up with Rav's Talmidim. But Omalu, when he asked him, "Mi Omer Rav Behema Gasa Niknas Meshicha?" Did Rav really say that a Behema Gasa can be acquired with Meshicha? V'hanan Mesira Tanan. Didn't it say in the Mishnah Mesira? So how is Rav arguing? How is Rav arguing with the Mishnah? V'Rav Nami B'Mesira Omer. And Rav himself regularly says that a behemah gasa can be acquired only by Mesira. Has Rav changed his mind and now he holds differently? That's how Rashi parses the words in the Gemara. The Ran brings a different explanation that Rav's Talmidim are answering Shmuel. Yes, Rav used to regularly say this, but he changed his mind. So where does Rav get this from? So who do Amaki Hai Tana? Because Rav is following the following Tana from a Braisa that disagrees with the Mishnah. And the Braisa can disagree with the Mishnah. The Tanya Vachum, I mean, the Braisa says, when we say in the Mishnah Vachumim Zubazumim, that so here in our Mishnah we had said that a behemah gasa is only Niknis Mesira, and we had no opinion that argued with that. But the Braisa says, Vachumim Zubazuba Mashicha, the Chum say, both kinds of animals, a behemah gasa and a behemah dakna, can be acquired with mashicha. So Rav, when he says they can be acquired with mashicha, is following that. Reb Shimon says that the only way, both with a behemah gasa or a behemah daka, is going to be by lifting them up. Neither mesira nor mashicha would work according to Reb Shimon. Now, of course, there are other, so the Gemara is going to ask, in that case, according to Reb Shimon, how do you acquire a cow or something like that? You can't physically lift it up. But the point is, so far we have four different opinions about it. We have the Tanakama of our Mishnah had said, Mesira for a behemah gasa and Hagbah for a behemah daka. That was the Reb Meir and Reb Lozer in our Mishnah had said that. The Chum in our Mishnah had said, Mesira for a behemah gasa, Meshicha for a behemah daka. The Braisa that Rav was following said that the Chachamim say both of them can be Mashicha, and Reb Shimon is saying both of them Hagbah. So the question is, Maskel Rabbi Yosef, Ela Me'ata, by that logic, by Reb Shimon, if Reb Shimon is saying that Behema Gasa you can acquire only by lifting, so fine, when it comes to a cow or something, okay, one person can't lift it, but fine, you can get enough people together and they can lift it. But how are you supposed to, Reb Shimon, according to Reb Shimon, suppose that one person sells an elephant to somebody else? How are you supposed to make a kinyan on it? You can't pick it up. Now, Tosfos brings up the point. Why don't we say that it should be, according to Rashi, that with a behemah gasa, you can only be koine b'mesira. And not even the Tanakh that the Reb Meir and Reb Lozer of our Mishnah had said you can't even be kona with Meshicha or with Hagbah. only with Mesira, well, then the question, you could ask this question also, never mind selling it. What if you're acquiring an elephant from Hefker? How are you going to do it? There's nobody to do Mesira to you. And the answer that no, Rashi would agree. When it comes to Hefker, Meshicha is fine. The question is only here, where Reb Shimon is saying, Hagbar is the only way when you're buying from somebody else, then what do you do with an elephant? So Abaye says you have other ways of kinyanim. You have altogether like 10 different ways that are in different areas of halacha where kinyan is valid. Not all 10 apply in every case, but you have enough of them that apply to metalplin. One of them is you can buy something with kinyan chalifin, inami b'socher es mekaymai, or you can rent the place where the elephant is, and then you're acquiring it. Now we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it a little further in our parable. We'll learn tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, about the concept of kinyan agav, where you sell somebody or gift somebody land, and together with it go to the metalklin. So here it would be the same kind of thing. You give somebody the land, and the elephant that's standing in that land is also nicknamed with kinyan agav. Another part of the Shach brings up a possibility, maybe instead it's Kenyan Chotzer. Whatever the case, the point is, even according to Reb Shimon, you don't have to lift up the elephant, you have other ways of accomplishing it. Reb Zera said, you have another way. Maybe our bar kalim, you bring four kalim, umanichan tachas raglav, and you put one kali under each leg of the elephant. So now what you have is the elephant, the four legs of the elephant are standing inside your kalim. So that's good, your kalim are koinin for you. Achronim bring up a point, by the way, obviously not all of the elephant is inside the kalim, so is that good enough, even though most of it is sticking out? And they discuss that point. If you're acquiring something through a kinyan kali or kinyan or a kinyan like that, does it have to be that it's completely inside the thing, which is that's relevant as far as the halachas of gittin. When you're giving a get, do you have to make sure that the complete get is inside the wife's hand, or would we say that not? So there's some discussion about this. Okay, the Eger brings up the point, and other Achronim discuss the ins and outs of it. Anyway, so here you have another way of accomplishing a kinyan with an elephant. So the Gemara asks, "Shamet mina pelev shalakeach b'rishus moicha kana hakana lekeach?" Can you say that you can derive from what Reb Zera is saying that if you, the lekeach, put your kalim in the property of the moicha, in the property of the seller, that you can acquire something by placing something inside your keli? It's not so simple. The Gemara discusses this in Bava Basra. If you're standing in the chotzer of the seller and you put your kalim down over there and you put something inside the kalim, not necessarily are you kalim koina for you. Here, the way Reb Zera, it's a machlokas amiroyim. So the way Reb Zera is saying that it would work over here with the kalim under the elephant's feet. So it sounds like that would work. And in fact, Tosfos says there are ways. I mean, the Gemara could have easily answered it's not in the Rishus of the Moicher, but usually that's where the sale would take place. It could also be, for example, when he says clearly, Yikna l'chol kelecha, your kelim should acquire for you, but we're assuming Reb Zera is saying in a generic way, it sounds like it would always work. So the Gemara answer is not necessarily. Hochab Mayaskin and Basimta, you could say that we're not talking about in the Rishus of the Moicher, you're talking about in a side street over here. In Rishus Arabim, it wouldn't, the Kenyan Kaili wouldn't work. In Rishus HaYochid that belongs to the seller, it wouldn't work either. It may or may not work, depending on Machlokas HaMeroyim. But when you have a Simta, a side street, where people have the right to put down, it's not Rishus HaRabim, it's not Rishus HaYochid, so therefore people can put down their Kalim over there, and people can sit and people can put their Kalim or whatever. So it's a valid place to make a Kenyan using a Kalim over there. So you could have, you bring the elephant into a Simta, and you put down the Kalim over there. Inami, or the Gemara finishes off, b'chavilei zmoris. Another way you could accomplish Kenyan of an elephant would be with bundles of branches. Now, what does that mean? Rashi explains that what you do is you put down a pile of branches on the ground that where the top of the pile is three or more tefachim off the ground, and then you have the elephant step up onto that pile. So therefore, so that's also a kinyan agbah. You've now lifted it three tefachim off the ground. Tosfos, first of all, mentions you don't necessarily need, as far as agbah, you don't necessarily need three tefachim. One tefach would be enough. But more to the point, Tosfos says that you first of all, then in that case, according to that, kalim might not work because kalim are not usually that big. But in any case, Tosfos says that the question is, in that if you're just talking about making a platform for the elephant to stand on, why bother mentioning branches? You could say the same thing: build a platform out of stones or something, and have the elephant walk up onto that. So rather, Tosfos gives a different answer, that when we say over here chavilei zmoras, what we mean is you hold up, and zmoras branches are the kind of food are food that elephants will eat. We have a Gemara in Shabbos that mentions that. So what you do is you hold a bundle of branches like that above the elephant, and the elephant wants to get at the food, so it jumps up or lifts itself up to reach the food, and therefore that would be considered hagbah. An interesting bit of discussion about that. Can elephants physically do that? Can they jump? Zoologists usually say they can't, but there is some evidence that maybe when they're trying to get to food, they could. And maybe even just the fact that it's able to lift itself up on its hind legs, maybe that would be enough for the purpose. So therefore, so that kind of thing could work out. So those are ways in which even according to Reb Shimon, who requires Hagbah for Behema Gasa, so if you want to do Kinyan Hagbah, you can accomplish that with the Chavilei Zmoras, however these ways work, but you don't have to resort to Hagbah at all. You can use Kinyan Chotzer or Kinyan Agav or Chalifin or other methods like that.